So I'll just share with you what I found out about Christian mysticism and Sufism. Contemplation is the Christian word really for meditation. They call it contemplative prayer or contemplation. And Thomas Aquinas described contemplation as the simple intuition of divine truth. The simple intuition of divine truth, proceeding from a supernatural principle. I like the word simple, because real spiritual states, experiences, or the real spiritual path is basically the most simple thing that is. Why? Because it's to do with your essence. And your essence is the most simple part about you. The real spiritual path is incredibly simple. One of my favorite sayings of Jung is, it is so simple, if only simplicity were not the most difficult of things. Or as T.S. Eliot said, a condition of complete simplicity costing not less than everything. So, that's really the basis of the mystical path. It's like, be oneself. Just be yourself. Which is infinitely simple and, of course, infinitely difficult. And it's only as oneself, as one's own simple self, that one can ever have a mystical experience. Because the mystical experience is the relationship of your essence to the essence. So it's a simple intuition of divine truth. An intuition is nothing to do with thought. It's just given, it just comes, you just know. There is no rationale, there is no reason. And in fact, as you go on meditating, you create a space within yourself that allows this intuition to come into you. And then you just know. It's to do with knowing, that part of oneself that knows and is known. It's a two-way relationship. Spirituality, mysticism is a two-way relationship. One knows and one is known. Or one knows because one is known. Put it more precisely. One knows because one is known. Somebody somewhere knows who you are. And the conscious mind will never know who you are, because it is far beyond the conscious mind. And within the Christian mystical tradition, this state of being is described in this lovely saying from the Sermon on the Mount. Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They toil not, neither do they spin. And yet I say unto you, that Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. That is the state of our own being. It has nothing to do with wisdom. It just is. We are like that someone. And the spiritual path is just learning to create an empty space, so we can be shown that, so we can experience that. Except again, the bit of oneself that experiences is not the ego. It's like when Mrs. Tweedy was terribly upset with Baisab one time, because he said, when people ask me, have you realized God, have you realized the self? He said, he always replied, no, I haven't realized God, I haven't realized the self. And she said, but Baisab, how can you say that? You know, you're a great master. Of course you've realized God. Of course you've realized the self. And he said, but in those experiences, the ego isn't there. So who has realized God? Who has realized the self? To be absolutely correct, it is the self that realizes the self. It is God that realizes God. We, as the ego, have nothing to do with it. And that's why it is so fundamental on the spiritual path to get rid of the ego, or to get it to step out of the way. One doesn't get rid of it because you need the ego to function on this plane of existence. You cannot function in this world without an ego. If you don't have an ego, you don't know who you are. You don't know that you're separate from somebody else. So you need an ego, you need an I, you need an identity to drive a car, to walk down the street. But from a spiritual point of view, the ego has to get out of the way so the other experiences can come. So you can participate in God's experience of Himself. And as far as I understand, that is what a mystical experience is. You participate in His experience of Himself. You participate a little bit in His coming to know Himself. And His coming to know Himself is nothing other than oneself coming to know oneself. Because mystical experiences is just coming to know what you really are. I quote from Plotinus. In ecstasy, the vision of the absolute becomes a vision of the self. The ecstatic beholds himself as one grown simple, a self wrought to splendor, brimmed with the intellectual light, become that very light, pure, buoyant, unburdened, raised to godhood, or better, knowing its godhood. You see the splendor that you really are, you see the glory that you really are. And one of Mrs. Tweedy's first mystical experiences that she describes is when in meditation she went somewhere and there was no God there, and she'd always been brought up with a view of a personal God, but there was no personal God, there was just herself in absolute glory, in absolute splendor, and it was terrifying. It was so awesome, so full of awe. Because the mystic path takes one beyond any personal God, any form, beyond the form into the formless. And there one sees oneself as one really is. That's why on the mystical path you can't go anywhere. Because all you ever experience is yourself. Your own divinity. Or in a different way, he experiences himself in you, and you participate in that experience. I prefer that, because somehow, in my little experience, the mysticism is more about he experiencing himself. You do not experience anything, you partake in the beloved loving himself and coming to know himself better. Because this goes back to the whole basis of creation, the whole esoteric background. What is creation? He created out of himself in order that he might come to know himself. You can only know something if there is separation, if there is duality. If there is just one, you cannot know anything. You only know something when it is outside of yourself, when there are two. And so in order that he might come to know himself, he created out of himself. And through the mystic, he comes to know himself. Why? Because only through the mystic does he see through the mystic's eyes into creation. That's why mystic's eyes are different to other people's eyes. Because there is this spark that sees through into the world. And it's why Sufis are known as God's spies. You know, Sufis are known as God's spies. Why? Because they look into the hearts of people. They look for him into people's hearts. And they also clean people's hearts for him, so that he can see himself more clearly reflected in people's hearts. So the mystical path is just coming to know oneself. And oneself is God. We are made in His image. It is God within us that reveals His own light to us. It is the self that reveals God to us. God reveals Himself to us. It's said in the Psalms, "In thy light shall we see light." We can only see the light in His light. It's like only in His presence can we see Him. Only when He is there can we see that He is there. It sounds so simple, it sounds so paradoxical. But it's like the whole of the mystical preparation, the whole of the preparation for the path, is to create a space within the heart so that He can come. And when He comes, then in His light, we see His light. You can't see in the darkness. You have to wait for Him to turn on the light. And then you see the light. It's very simple. Ibn al-Arabi said exactly the same thing as in the Psalms. "I created perception in thee, only that therein I might become the object of my perception." He allowed us to see only that we might one day see Him. That is the sole purpose of perception. That is the sole purpose of us having eyes. That one day He might be able to see Himself through our eyes. I mean, to put it terribly bluntly, He created us in order that we might get out of the way. And then, through us, He is able to experience Himself. Through us, He is able to get to know Himself and love Himself. Because it's a relationship of love. And that's why the mystic path has to be a relationship of love. So that He can love His own creation through us. And there is a very special esoteric purpose of the mystical path. That mystics form a point of light within the world that allows many, many other things to happen. This is a secret of, in the ancient traditions, of why were the monasteries that were just contemplative? What good did they do the world? Well, they prayed for the world, but also they held the light of the world. And without that light within the world, there would be great darkness within the world. It's like this lovely saying by Corbin about Sufis being a brotherhood of migrants who keep watch on the world and for the world. Without that still center that one finds within meditation, many things could not happen in the world. And that is the mystic's purpose. And it is not a purpose of doing, it is a purpose of being. It in a way forms the axis, the spiritual axis of the world. This particular Sufi path is only concerned with people whose one desire is to realize the truth. It is not interested in anything else. It's not that it doesn't discourage people who want to go out and do all sorts of other things. That is the purpose. It's to give a space for people whose one desire, one interest, one purpose is to realize the truth. And that brotherhood of seekers forms the axis. It's almost an axis of light within the world. From above to below. That is the purpose. And through that axis, many other things can happen in the world that are not even the business of the Sufi, that the Sufi is not even concerned with. And that is why contemplation, why this inward prayer that is without words, is so important. It is a relationship with the Absolute. that is the axis of this work. Because in the deepest sense, the whole purpose of creation is so that he can come to know himself. And the Sufi holds that purpose within the heart as their purpose, and that nothing else matters. And that's why on this path there will never be many, because that isn't the purpose. Sufis do not convert, because that isn't the purpose. They hold this space within the heart. Just as in monasteries of the past, in different times, there were monastic orders of contemplation who understood the deepest purpose of prayer, which is to hold the light of the world. And in fact, the entire activity of the mystic should consist in prayer. His whole life should be one continuous prayer, because nothing else matters. And here again, I'm not talking about prayer of words. It is an inner attitude. It isn't what the Sufi calls remembrance, the continual remembrance of him. And that allows him to be here. If we remember him, that is the place in which he can walk in his world, through us. And that's why at times the mind has to go, because the mind gets in the way. Because the mind is to do with duality. And when he wants to be in his world, there should be no separation. And in fact, one is often not even allowed to know that this is taking place. It is such an intimate relationship he has with this creation, that in some of the very deep moments of meditation, one is not even there. One is not even aware that this intimate relationship is taking place. One surrenders oneself so completely to him that one doesn't mind, that one doesn't know what he is doing. That is the real relationship of the lover and the beloved. It is a state of surrender. You say, use me. I do not even mind if I don't know what is happening. And this is really the Sufi practice of remembrance, continually, also known as solitude in the crowd. Whatever your outward activities, you create in the heart a space for him to be. So he can walk in the marketplace with you. He can walk in his marketplace as you walk in his marketplace. Again, it's this very intimate relationship. In the Christian tradition, there's this lovely book, The Practice of the Presence of God, by Brother Lawrence, in which Brother Lawrence, the monk Brother Lawrence, whatever he did with Jesus. Whatever he did with Christ. He washed the potatoes with Christ. He worked in the kitchen. Whatever he did with God. So there was continually this relationship that allowed the beloved into his life. And also, by reflection, into the lives of those around him. Because if he is in one's heart, he is reflects himself into others' hearts, into the lives of others. Not by doing, just by being. The light, his light, gets reflected in our hearts. His light is reflected from our hearts, if we allow him into our hearts. And in order to allow him into our hearts, we have to get out of the way. We have to not be there. And the deepest yearning of the soul, like Meister Eckhart said, God is the sigh in the soul, is the longing that this might happen, that we might fulfill ourselves in his creation. That is the deepest longing, that he might come into our hearts. A great Christian, Dionysius the Areopagite, said, that prayer is naught else but a yearning of the soul. Okay, it has nothing to do with words. It is one's soul yearning, longing. It's like, it works that you yearn, you long upwards so he can come down. It's a meeting place. He within your heart longs for him. And that allows him to come into your heart. It is this two-way relationship. The spark in the heart longs for the source. And the source longs to be in the spark in the heart. And again, it's this two-way relationship. He desires us and we desire him. In the Christian tradition, there are three different stages of the path. There is purification, illumination, and vision. And this is exactly the same in the Sufi path, in any mystical path. Because real mystics are the same. There is the deepest brotherhood is the brotherhood of mystics. It's like on one level all teachers are the same, they are all one. There is no difference. There can be no difference because they are one with that. So how can there be a difference? They just speak a different language to the people around them, that's all. But on the deepest level they are one. And the first stage of the path is purification. And purification is the process of emptying, emptying, emptying. What the Sufis call getting rid of the nafs, of the little self. In the Christian tradition they talk about sins, cleansing one's sins. In many dreams this is expressed in images of cleaning, cleaning, cleaning. You clean and you clean and you clean. You purify and you purify and you purify. In alchemy you turn your inner lead, your inner darkness, the shadow, into gold. You work and you purify, and it's a long, laborious process which requires the utmost attention. Because that aspect, one's darkness, will try and hide from you. It will try and escape into different corners of your life when you don't look. And you have to be incredibly diligent all the time and all the time. And yet there's another side. It's like St. Augustine who said, Lord, make me perfect, but not today. One has to also include one's humanity within it. That one's just an ordinary human being, one has a life to live. That's why the Sufis choose the middle way. You live in the world, enjoy things of the world, why not? But just don't get too attached to them. In fact, a real state of inner purity and renunciation has nothing to do with the outer. It's an inner attitude of detachment. He wants us free. A man once brought a Sufi 1,000 dinars. Take, he said. I do not accept anything from beggars, the Sufi replied. But I am wealthy, the man retorted. Do you want more than you have already? The Sufi asked. Of course, the man exclaimed. Then take it back, said the Sufi. You are the chief of beggars. If a wealthy person wants more, then they must be very poor. But the deepest attitude of renunciation is you don't want anything. You know he will give you what you need. And that is the inner state to which one should aspire. That is the state of inner purification. Because then your energy is not towards getting, but towards offering. If you want something, and there's a difference here between a want and a need, you need certain things. Like in America, you seem to need a motor car. And you need gas to put in your motor car. Otherwise you can't get around. You can't live in the world as it is here. You need a bed, you need clothes. Those are all things you need. But then think of all the things you want. And you'll find that your energy is being directed to the things you want. And your preoccupation is what you want. And your wants live you. Your whole life then becomes a preoccupation with these things you want. So you're not free. And you're not free to be with the beloved either. Because he is a jealous lover. And he demands total attention. So to be free is to take what he gives you. And he will always give you enough. Always. If you give yourself to him, he has to look after you. It is the deepest covenant. It's his... it's his covenant with you. He has to look after you. He can't not look after you. But he will give you what you need, which is very different to what you want. And if you need to suffer, he will give you suffering. Because suffering is great purification. Like Baisav once said to Mrs. Tweedy, you came here to suffer, so suffer. Stop complaining. She needed to suffer because suffer is the process of purification. Suffering cleanses one's inner self. It's the fire that burns you up. Well, the spiritual path, there is also the longing that burns you up. It is also the fire that burns you up. And if he wants to make you insecure, he will make you insecure. Don't worry. You just have to let it happen. You have to surrender to what he gives you. It's like Mother Teresa says, take whatever he gives with a smile. That is the deepest part of surrender. And then your attention can always be on him. Your focus can always be on him. You can allow yourself to be used by him as he wills. And the ego will just scream in the corner. But actually this very mysterious process of transformation happens. Because the moment you begin to surrender, then he can give you something. And once he's given you something, you don't want the world anyway. Once you've tasted something else, you're not interested. He turns your attention, it's quite a simple matter. He turns your attention from here to there. And then you're not interested. Well, you are, because you get thrown back in the world, and all your desires come up again. And you live through them, and you fight through them, and you suffer through them. I mean, I had a lovely personal experience myself. Whenever I got something I really wanted, it always broke down. It was, if I look back in my life, it was remarkable. I remember when I was 18 and I saved up for my first stereo set. You know, within a week it had broken down. I always wanted one of these VW camper vans. You know, I had a great desire. Somewhere I had a sort of tortoise mentality in like carrying my house on my back. And this was to me was security. I could go wherever I want. So eventually I got one. The first holiday I took it on with the family, 4 hours onto the journey and the engine blew up. I mean, it was, you know, we started out at 5 a.m. after our first holiday with the tent and all the stuff in the back. And being at 12 o'clock that night, we were being towed back by a van. It happened like the first bicycle, I really wanted this bicycle. Bang, the gears were broken within a week. It was so remarkable. It was so... the detailing, the finesse, you know. he loved detailing. He has such a sense of humour. It's like, I must tell you, the story that happened to a friend near, she's not here today, that she had to go back to the East Coast to see her mother. And she always had a difficult relationship. And she prayed to Baisav, please this time don't let me get caught up with these patterns of the past with my mother. So she got on the plane, and she had to first go to Los Angeles and then change to Texas and then go to Jacksonville, right? And the first plane was delayed, and the second plane was delayed even more, and there was a terrible thunderstorm, and the plane was delayed even more, and it was a appalling journey, and she got to Jacksonville, and they got to Jacksonville so late that the plane, the Savannah Airport was closed, and they got to Jacksonville at 11, so they said, they were offered either you can stay in a hotel here, or you can go in the bus, or we'll take you in a taxi up to Savannah, which is about 300 miles or something. So she thought, well, she might as well go in the bus. And they got into the bus, and after 15 minutes, there was a siren, the police cars came, and stopped the bus for speeding. And this whole thing went on, and she eventually arrived at her mother's doorstep at 5:30 in the morning, having been travelling since over 24 hours or so, about 24 hours, absolutely shattered, absolutely exhausted. And she was so phased out and spaced out by this journey that she couldn't connect with her mother at all the whole of the journey there. So there was no danger of her getting involved with her mother. She was just totally jet-lagged and totally exhausted the whole time. So she had a wonderful sense of humor. Said, this is what you wanted, that's provided it for you. So that's the whole process of purification. It happens all the time. And I think one of the things on the path is learning not to fight it when it comes. You learn to listen to the hints. You learn to see your mistakes before you totally dig yourself in the sand and bury yourself altogether. And you learn to see, oh, I've done it again. And you always get, then there's always the guilt and the feelings of remorse and the feeling, you crucify yourself slowly for a little while and then you accept what you've done. But I mean, in my life experiences, you go on, you get to know the signs, you get to know what's happening, you don't rebel. You don't, it's like there's one spiritual law, if you try something three times, and if it doesn't work after the third time, you don't continue. If you continue after that, you may get what you want, but you will have to pay for it. And it works in all things. It's like if you try to contact something, you try three times, if you don't get it after that, you drop it. It's not meant to be. It's a very deep spiritual law. It's like if you ask, it works the other way. If you ask the teacher a question three times, he has to answer you. It's a law. If you knock three times, the door has to be open. But again, you get to know not to push. You see, we have great strong wills, so if we really want something, we can push our way to get it. And then you can at times have to pay even more than if you just... You learn to notice when you're not supposed to hug something. And so you learn to suffer as little as you need to. I mean, you still suffer. But you learn to go with the flow. You learn to read the signs of the inner world as they come to you. You just learn not to push life. You learn life to teach you the lessons it has to teach you. And you also, in my experience, you also learn that, you know, very often you make a mess. And you learn, you pay for it, fine. And then you go on. It's like you tune into this other way, that rather than you've got to get what you want from life, which I think is sort of very much a Western view. You know, life, you have a right to get something from life, and you know what it is, and you go out and get it. If you see it from a spiritual perspective, you see that life is trying to teach you something. And you allow yourself to be taught, hopefully. It's like one friend who had a lot of very difficult experiences in his life, and he had a dream in which he was taken up an elevator, and there he was in a classroom, and the teachers were all the people who caused him real trouble in his life. It would be really unpleasant. That's, from a spiritual point of view, that's how it works. That's why the Sufi says, give a place of honour in your garden to your enemy. But again, it's from a point of view of oneness, you see, that if you believe there is oneness, then you get given what you need. And how can you say that the enemy, your friend is God, but your enemy isn't God? He gives you what you need. That's again the difference of the spiritual perspective on the worldly perspective. As you get to know that, you get to realize you're given what you need. O dervishes, from the bottom of your heart be content with not having, and then you will find the reward of poverty. The true dervish is totally satisfied, patient and content. Satisfaction with what one receives is the core of poverty. And it's amazing saying how he gives you always what you need. Even if you don't like it, he gives you what you need. Always. And that is the process of purification, is learning to work with that dynamic and allow oneself to be purified. And also allow oneself to rebel at times. And then, I mean, to me that's interesting, because you rebel, you say, I want this, and you go out and get it, and you suffer like anything for it afterwards. And it always happens that way. And you learn to live with that too. So that's how it works outwardly, but part of the path is the introversion. You have the outer dynamic, but you become focused within, and that's where you see the whole change, the whole transformation taking place. St. Augustine said, return within yourself. In the inward man dwells truth. In narrowing down the spiritual horizon to the innermost soul, it is expanded. You somehow appear to limit your life. You're not interested in going off and doing all sorts of things. And the friends who you used to go off and do all these things with, you get a bit upset with you, because you're just not interested. The energy goes within. So Gregory the Great said, it narrows itself that it may be enlarged. You have to begin with this introversion, this going within, to hold the process, to find the center of yourself that can... It's like you find that rather than being centered in the outer world, you become centered in the inner world. Then you have to become rooted within yourself, within the inner world. Without going outside, you may know the whole world. Without looking through the window, you may know the ways of heaven. The further you go, the less you know. And it's from this inner core that the personal dialogue with God begins. You have to root yourself, within the heart. And all meditation practices are to do with that, are to do with becoming familiar with an inner space that you can always return to. And it's in that inner space that the real prayer, the real communication with the beloved takes place. It's like somewhere you're always open at any moment to what he has to say. You're always listening to someone, eventually. At the beginning, you only do it in the times you set aside for meditation. And that's why it's important to have that discipline. It's like you put aside 15 minutes, half an hour, whatever time you have, of your day, for that relationship with the beloved. You say, this time is for you. He doesn't need a lot of time. He doesn't need that you meditate all day, because we're talking about infinity. And if you go within your heart, you go into infinity. And 1 minute, if you're in there, actually 1 second, if you're in there, is infinite. It's like you just go off for 1 second and you've gone forever, because you go beyond time. But it's important, the discipline is important, because it's like an inner statement, an inner commitment to the path. This time is for you. And in my experience, at the beginning, that's the time that is in your life that is sacred, and then you get lost in the world and you come back to that space. You get lost in the world and you come back to that space. And then slowly, that space enlarges itself, sort of surreptitiously infuses itself into the rest of your life. So then when you're doing the dishes, suddenly he's there. Mm-hmm. When you're driving the car, suddenly you tune in somewhere and he has something to say to you. Or you're with somebody And suddenly, you know, the right thing to say exactly, it didn't come from you. He's speaking to you. And then this intimate relationship, this relationship with the beloved, becomes part and parcel of your everyday life, and it's terribly addictive. That is one of the unfortunate things about the mystical life. And the Sufis say you just taste the dregs of this glass of wine and you're lost forever. And I think that's any spiritual path. Once you've been shown something, it's totally addictive. And you know, what happens in the end is any time you have spare, you just want to meditate, because you just want to be with them. Mrs. Tweedy even says there comes a time when meditation is easier than not meditating. You have to make an effort to be here. You just so much want to be somewhere else. You so much want to be just this merging, just this oneness. But it really happens in your everyday life. He infuses himself, because you give a space to him, a space of prayer. He infuses himself into your everyday life. He creeps around the corners and is there when you don't expect him. And suddenly you're just tuning somewhere else. Or it tunes into you, it's really more appropriate. Because you don't, because you wouldn't even know how to do it. Suddenly, somebody's just tapping you on the back. It's like, hey. And in this inner prayer, you just ask him for himself. St. Augustine said, ask nothing of God but God. Why not go for the best? Why not go for the whole thing? There's this lovely Sufi story about Aziz and Mahmud, the emperor. It's in the Conference of the Birds. And the emperor had won a great campaign, and he had all these riches, and he was so happy with having won this campaign that he had all the jewelry and all the slaves and all the elephants brought into a great field. And he stood there and he said to his people, come in and take what you like. And so they all came in and they all took the slaves and the gold and the elephants. And his favorite slave, Aziz, just stood beside him. And after everybody had taken everything, the emperor said to Aziz, why didn't you take anything? And Aziz said, can you repeat what you said? And the emperor said, yes. Anybody can have anything they lay hands to that is in this field. So Aziz put his hand on the emperor's shoulder. And he is emperor after him. One Sufi had a dream about Abu Yazid, who's one of our great superiors. And in this dream he had a vision of God, and God said to him, everybody desires something from me but Abu Yazid. He always asks only for myself. See, that's the real mystical prayer. One doesn't ask for something. You can pray for other people, yes, we often pray for other people. But for oneself, why not ask for the outcome? I have second best. It's like Mrs. Tweedy says, we deserve the best. Sufis only get the best. We have a right to the best. So that is the deep prayer, if there is a prayer in words. The deepest prayer is beyond words. But if one has a prayer in words, actually even a prayer beyond words is saying that. The yearning of the soul is asking him for himself. He's asking nothing else. Just wanting. And you have a right to want him. You have a right to demand him totally. I mean, that's the beauty. Any other relationship, you have to compromise.